Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence and a new year. Happy New Year 2025,
sure. Happy New Year, Harry.
So, what a year last year was.
Very busy.
Yeah, 26 podcasts.
So, in total, by the end of it, 26 podcasts.
26 podcasts.
A few more than we anticipated.
It was a few more than we planned. And by the way, for the record to our listeners, the way we run these podcasts is that I pontificate and I pretend to know what I'm talking about. Sean does all the preparation and all the organization. So, Sean, thank you for that extra work you've done. We have done a great deal of work this year. Well, I should be honest and say you've done a great deal of work this year getting these podcasts. Thank you. Now, just the sheer volume and breadth of challenges that are in the world, it's got us thinking about how OSINT is understood, how it's being used, how it's developing and maturing. And we've covered all kinds of topics. So I thought what we might do, Sean, today, in the absence of a guest, because everybody else is quite rightly sitting at home drinking a glass of something nice, eating your mince pie or whatever they choose to do at Christmas and New Year, let's just go through some of the things that we've done. Now, just to get us started, I think of all the topics we've discussed this year, the two that come out loud and clear for me are misinformation, disinformation, and the use of AI. Now, there are other things we can talk about, but from my perspective, those are the two that really stood out for me. We've spent quite a lot of time this year talking about mis- and disinformation, but also about the uses of AI.
Absolutely. And that's it shouldn't be any surprise, really, because those are probably the two of the most topical elements on not just talking about open source intelligence, but actually society as well.
Yeah.
You know, AI is pervasive everywhere. You know, there's a debate right now as to, you know, have we reached a certain almost like a speed bump in terms of we've got as far as we can as a tool. That's one view of looking at it. To another view about, we're nowhere near there yet.
Yeah.
And of course, there's those that think it's the best thing to science spread and those that won't touch it still.
Yeah.
And that's reflected some of our discussion.
Yeah, and we've had conversations about what is AI. We've had conversations about how AI might be used. We had a conversation just before Christmas and New Year with Harry from Jane's about the pros and cons of large language models. I think we've really looked at it. I think my takeaway from all those conversations is that, as with many tools, if you know how to use the tool effectively, the chances are it will be useful to you and you can use it with some degree of care, but you can definitely get something from it. But use blindly, use without due care and attention, it can really get into trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that was an excellent one to round off the year, wasn't it? But, and I think, as I said at the time, that, you know, AI is not a panacea, but it's a really useful tool.
Yeah.
But you've got to kind of treat it in many ways like you would an analyst. I don't mean put it in a box and leave it there. What I really mean is that, yeah, exactly. You know, you have to follow the, and it is right at the beginning of the year, but I'm going to use the word tradecraft.
Yeah.
Even if it's ones and noughts as opposed to, you know, an individual analytical tradecraft.
Yeah. When you think about the words that people like Keith Dears spoke us about in terms of what it was, his applications. I think he actually used a phrase which I quite like, that to not use AI and advanced analytical tools these days would almost be tantamount to negligence in the world of national security, because it is such a powerful tool if you know what you're doing with it. And then on a similar vein, Martin, when he came in on the future applications piece, and he was talking about artificial general intelligence, which I know is not a universally accepted concept and not everyone buys into the idea that we are potentially quite close to it being achieved. But nonetheless, we need to accept that genie is out of the bottle and we need to start thinking about how we're going to grapple with it and use it so that the tool becomes useful to us rather than our master.
Absolutely. And I think we'll probably return to that this year just for that very reason, that, you know, you can sit there in the past and sort of not engage. But the fact is that AI is going to develop and you've got to embrace it and use it in the way that it's going to be most beneficial.
Yeah. Now, moving through AI brings me back to some discussions, as I mentioned at the beginning, around mis- and disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a long while ago, didn't we, about the creation of deepfake videos and the fact that AI was creating them. And then we talked about how only AI could spot deepfakes, etc. Well, I got a very similar feeling talking to the topic through the course of the year in the various podcasts we did. Well, one of the things that we got very early on last year when we spoke to Emil Khan, the ex-journalist from Reuters and BBC, was that he mentioned something that has stuck with me ever since, which is that way of detecting that perhaps you are suffering from what some people call the echo chamber, or that you are becoming, without knowing it, perhaps more and more biased in your views because of the way you're working with media. And it's something I've actually spent a lot of time in my own professional capacity looking at, and looking at how I engage with media. Emil talked about the article heading that you are drawn to and you find yourself reading is the one that you need to check to, because that is probably telling you something about your own echo chamber that you're creating around yourself. So I think there's a topic which we might want to pick up this year, Sean, about what can I do to help myself ensure I'm getting as close to truth, and again, what some people are calling the post-truth age.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, this is the one of the things I worry more about than you know, the potential for nuclear Armageddon, right?
In fact, if you're not aware of our podcast, you actually thought this was potential to unravel democracy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, polarization of society, it really is. And as we mentioned in another means, actually, that, and I think this is what you're alluding to in terms of coming back to, there's a personal responsibility here in terms of making sure that you're balanced enough in terms of what you absorb and however you absorb it. And therefore giving a worldview so that you actually almost you contribute to not that echo chamber and filter bubble, but are able to have a balanced conversation. Now, you know, how does that read across to open source intelligence? Well, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Is that the unconscious bias, which we've got to be so careful about, is that analysts are tempted to use the same sources that they know work pretty well, and they know provide them with a good analysis and filled in some gaps. So naturally, they're going to go back to those.
Sure.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But what you mustn't do in that effect is say, well, I'm not going to look at over here for this source. And this is where, and again, back to the tradecraft piece, you need to at least consider, that doesn't mean include, every available source on something. You can absolutely disregard stuff, but you've actually got to go in through each one.
Yeah, I liked the way in our discussions around mis- and disinformation, a way of checking yourself includes deliberately go and find an article on a piece of news from a source that you know is likely to give it a slant that you don't normally read.
Yeah.
So if you read this kind of organization's work and they tend towards the left or right spectrum, find the alternative, the opposite
end of
the spectrum. And the way it was described to me is if you feel yourself becoming irritated by what you're reading, again, it's a symptom of you becoming perhaps too far down one end of the spectrum than the other in terms of your echo chamber that you're creating around yourself.
Indeed.
A fascinating discussion. And I think we should pick up on that again this year. We've also spent quite a lot of time, an increasing amount of time, looking at specific events that have been going on through the year.
Yeah.
We've looked at Sudan, Bangladesh, Yemen, of course, what's been going on in Ukraine and Lavon, and how open source intelligence has been applied to understanding those events. And I think one of the things that's come out for me is that open source may well be now increasingly used as the primary source, at least initially, and that it might become the first choice rather than the last choice for understanding what's happening in some of these places.
Yeah, and that's the debate that's definitely raging within government right now. And you know, we've heard Randy, I think it was Randy Nixon that came up, it needs to become the intelligence of first resource. And that's absolutely fine because of just the sheer volume of data and the all-pervasive nature of it and the global nature of it. I think we should, reiterate that it's not going to completely take over from traditional intelligence, secret intelligence, classified, but it can provide that really big, you know, the iceberg, the part of the iceberg underneath the surface. You're always going to need the exquisite stuff that goes, okay, I need something more specific. I need to know what certain person's thinking, or I need to know a little bit more about that. That only very expensive, exquisite stuff can come against. But going back to, you know, the crisis stuff that we've been talking about, what's been very clear is that you can get a pretty good picture from open sources. But of course, as we discussed, you know, there's a real role, whereas maybe 2 years ago, if we had this discussion, we'd talk about foundation intelligence, gap filling, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the initial triage, right, crikey, something's happened. Where is it? What's happening? Why has it happened? And as we've seen, actually, with particularly in the Middle East, but others as well, actually, Sudan, you mentioned as well, open source analysts are able to get very, very clear idea about what's happening, partly because they're data sources, but partly, and this applies to all analysts, is because they've got the background experience they've been looking at.
I agree. I think one of the things that's struck me during the course of the year, particularly in these reviews of specific crisis events, is the depth, the breadth, the quality of the analysis we've heard. It felt very similar to me to the kind of breadth and depth and quality I would have expected from the exquisite sources you just spoke about. In other words, where open source might be disregarded or previously have been disregarded as a nonsense source, actually, it's very clear that with the right tradecraft, the right availability of good sources, you can actually produce a very cogent, very reasonable understanding of what's happening. And in fact, in some regards, I think we're getting a better view than we might be getting from some of the more traditional government-based sources, because they have their own agendas. I found some of the discussions around, for example, what's been happening in events in the Levant, for example, have been often more close to what I suspect is actually true than what that which I've read in some of the formal government announcements as we go through all those news sources. So I think there's a degree of truth and legitimacy from open source that is becoming clearer and clearer to me.
That's a really interesting point. And one that's being discussed at the moment is that, to what extent is the intelligence community becoming politicized?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily due to its own fault, but of course, you know, it's all about who's asking the questions and what questions are being asked. But I think, and one area I'd like to get back to that we covered briefly, but I don't think we have done anything really in depth about, is culture. The culture of the organization from which you come.
Yeah.
And that includes everything from diversity to exactly as you've said, in terms of the sources that you're using, the perceived wisdom. We do things this way because we've always done them this way.
Mm.
And you know, the open source community, commercial community is not immune to that at all either. But it's how you optimize a culture to come up with the best assessment analysis, which I suspect there's some PhD thesis in there. It's probably already been done, but I would like to come back to the cultural issue at some stage.
Yeah, we've talked about culture in the past in terms of resistance to open source.
Indeed.
And we've also talked about it around AI in terms of, I think you said a few minutes ago, the two camps of AI. It's nonsense, it's got to its highest degree of capability, or it's got a long way to go. It's another area for us to discuss for next year, I'm sure. One of the things that I recall from our discussions around particular scenarios that we looked at in terms of current is we also looked at some predictive stuff, didn't we? We talked about how we might use the open source arena to look at what might happen in the future. And as I recall, we talked about, I think you called it the High North, the Arctic region, and looking at open source for the power it can bring in terms of predictive understanding.
Absolutely. And there's a piece of work that's going on that we will do a podcast on, actually, with a couple of the analysts here about, you know, the likelihood of China invading Taiwan. And that's so I would know it as INW indicators and warnings. And actually what's been really interesting is seeing Jane's produce a fairly sophisticated world model that will have a look at that. You know, forecasting or predicting is the nirvana for the intelligence world. The amount of times that I've had a senior guy, tongue-in-cheek maybe, or maybe not, say to me, Sean, I read the paper today, now tell me what's going to happen.
Yeah, what's going to happen.
Which is the, you know, and this is where, again, AI comes in, because if you can do trend analysis and model analysis, say, right, if the same conditions happen as happened here, this is the most likely outcome, then you know, we've got a better chance. But we will, I think we should,
Yeah.
We did quite well. If you remember, on the Venezuela elections, we put ourselves out there, and the day before, I think it was it was a couple of days before, when this is what we think is going to happen, based on, you know, a lot of analytical rigor, and actually we were pretty much 100% right.
Yeah, spot on. I think the kind of questions that we know all organizations are trying to answer: what happened, why has it happened, and then what might happen.
Yeah.
Leads very nicely onto, so how do I keep good things happening, and how do I stop bad things happening, and then what can I learn from it? Well, those five questions for me are the fundamental questions that any analyst is trying to answer in one way or the other. So in terms of looking ahead, we've talked this year about some of the really, really important insights you can get from open source around crisis events. I've forgotten one, actually. We talked about some of the more difficult targets, like...
Yes.
You know, the ability to get behind the scenes. That was a fascinating conversation we had earlier this year as well.
It was, and, you know, I talk about North Korea as the hardest target. I spent a little bit of time looking at it, and, you know, there's so little intelligence out there, although we may get some more out with, you know, every cloud is a silver lining. If we get reflections from the North Koreans on the battlefield, hopefully off the battlefield, then we might start to get there. But it's such a close society, it's hard. But the really great thing about that was two very clever analysts who really know their stuff. We're looking at a lot of the diplomatic activity.
Yeah, yeah.
What was said.
And what wasn't.
And who was the audience and what wasn't said, exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, everything that they predicted is kind of coming to pass now. So at the strategic level, I think there's a lot to be said for that level of analysis. I mean, how effective, you know, the North Korean troops are, we may know in due course, etc. But, sure. You know, if you said to me, and you'll see figures, things like North Korean troops, how many are there actually active troops in North Korea? And there's anything from, you know, 500,000 to 1.5 million plus, because we just don't know. You can have the best imagery in the world and you're still probably not going to know until the site is open. But that was a great example of where you can still use commercially and publicly available sources, as I said, diplomatic meetings, all the rest of it, to come out at least with the intent. Actually, this is one of the times where you can come up with the intent as much as the capability, more so when normally it's the other way around.
But what I just remember about that conversation with North Korea in mind is that you can't just look at a snapshot of a specific diplomatic event. You've got to have that long-term look. You've got to understand what looks normal. And equally, be able to understand the language being used. Because one of the things Christine was saying very clearly was, you've got to understand that they use what language in a very deliberate way. They're trying to say something. They're trying to communicate something. And it's not just a random set of words they're using to describe. I think they're being very specific. Equally, who's saying it? How senior they are, how close they will be to the power, the center of power.
And that's a great example of, you know, both of the analysts we had on are very steeped in that subject. They are experts.
Indeed.
And really know their stuff.
Yeah. All right. So what else could we bring into this conversation looking forward? I think there are couple of three things that we really want to pick up on. There, you talked about culture. I think we're going to talk about AI, misinformation, disinformation again. I think there are a number of things we could do. We've got a conversation that we had with Claire
Fuller
on language.
Yeah.
I've not done enough on that because that's related to
culture. I'm not sure if that's going to be published yet. Probably it's probably the next one to be published. Actually, fascinating discussion. Again, back to AI. You know, can it detect nuances in the way languages are used?
Yeah.
And I remember one of your original vignettes, you talk about tornado.
Mm.
You know, is that a weather phenomenon or is it a type of aircraft?
Yeah.
But it's a lot more than that. And, you know, I do commend the podcast when it comes out, because just the turn of phrase, which if you translate it means absolutely nothing. I won't spoil the effect of it, but language is important, and we probably will.
The other good thing about that podcast, I recall, is that it's one of a couple now where we've been asked questions.
Yes, that's true.
Asking to bring that up.
That's absolutely
true. I also realized as I'm beginning to bring this conversation to a close, the one thing we didn't talk about was that podcast we had about whether OSINT needs to exist as OSINT anymore.
So I was going to come to that actually, because the thread throughout all of these, of course, is as we want to, is to kind of, you know, expose open source intelligence to the masses. I mean, what does it mean? But also the journey that's on, and I think the word is journey. I mean, to the extent that a little bit tongue in cheek, but to distinguished academics that postulated there's no such thing as OSINT.
Yeah.
What they meant actually, maybe what they meant, and people will deduce their own from it, is that, you know, we've got to stop thinking of it as our own discipline, because, you know, it's multiple disciplines, if you like, so SIGINT, HUMINT, all the rest of it, but in the open source domain. So does that make it any difference? And there was a discussion of that we won't go into too much, but I think that the discussion needs to, and we're ahead of the acting it now. So what's next? What are we looking at?
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, the poor old intelligence community saying, well, I haven't got funding to actually set up this particular open source intelligence set, and I haven't got the data. So we need to be careful. But this is, you know, this is where I think I like to think that we're helping the debate move on, because I think what we need to have a look at next is beyond open source intelligence. I've been thinking about this quite a lot, actually, because all of the tradecraft, so the analytical standards, the way we do business in terms of making sure we've got the right sources and we're not overweighing them and all the rest of it applies to pretty much everything where you need to have a good understanding of what's why things are happening, what's happening and why things are happening. And so that applies way, way beyond those open source intelligence. And I think we should probably start to look a little bit more about what we know as the non-traditional threats. So, you know, climate change, apply the same rigor to the analysis of climate change. That would be an interesting one.
Yeah.
And migration, all the rest of it, because, you know, that will inform. And there's some debate over there, which is not particularly well informed. Now, obviously, there are analysts that do that rigor, but it doesn't happen always. And so I think we should do a little bit of the non-traditional stuff, but also in a context that's not about open source intelligence. It might be about where do I invest money?
Yeah.
Because what's the best environment to do that in? And it could be from a threat perspective, but more likely is from a, okay, do we have the people who will invest in it? What's the economic climate like, et cetera, et cetera. So I think taking it beyond open source intelligence, I use that. Rather than no such thing as open source intelligence. And of course, you know, if you're sitting in NATO right now, you're as interested in the capabilities of your partners and allies. So that is definitely not intelligence. As you are the adversary, you've probably been studying forever.
Yeah.
But if you've got an interesting, you know, partner that wants to come and say, look, we like what you do, we want to be part of it. You need to be able to assess, okay, excellent. What can you bring to the party? What do we need to increase your interoperability and bring you on board? So that is just as valid as. Yeah.
I wonder whether the beyond OSINT is really saying that to have described something as a capability, open source intelligence, has been useful because it's focused the minds.
Yeah,
it's got people to think and talk about it in a way that otherwise might have just been not done. For example. Although I hear it a great deal less these days, I still hear too frequently a statement that shows that the individual making the statement thinks that open source intelligence means access to social media that has been summarized.
Correct.
And sentiment analysis is done on it.
Yes.
And that somehow that is open source intelligence. It is absolutely part of.
One element of.
But it is not all that could be done from the open source. And I hope that what we've done this last year is show all the things that we've applied it to are all part of open source intelligence, and that therefore talking about open source intelligence as, in quotes, a discrete capability has been useful if only to focus the mind. Now, whether that is actually on a continuum, so that if you're doing, I don't know, imagery analysis and you work for the National Geospatial Agency in the US, you know, you're doing it with highly classified sources, but you're still doing geospatial intelligence analysis, the same kind of analysis actually indeed. These days with other satellite imagery you can buy with a credit card,
yep.
An average person in theory could do.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the important distinction, is that it's been helpful to address the matter that is of the capabilities that are available to us in the open source environment. And now it's focused the mind. Please be careful we don't overstate it, because the creation of, quote, open source intelligence centers is potentially creating a series of unnecessary complications in structure,
yeah.
For sure. All right, so let's now put our marker down for the year coming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from my perspective, I already know what I think is my most important takeaway from 2024 that I'm carrying into this year, 2025. So I'm going to give you a moment to think about what your most important takeaway is, because for me, that mine, which I'll describe in a second, is where I'd like to focus as much attention as we can afford it. And that is that, and actually, I think you used the phrase earlier, Sean, I think all of us should have, particularly people listening to this podcast, who we could assume care about matters of intelligence and truth and getting to the bottom of things. So if I assume the listener is the kind of person that cares about it, then let me offer you this. I think there is a personal responsibility for everybody to try and be as, quote, data literate as possible.
Absolutely.
In the modern day, in order to deal with the ridiculous conspiracy theories that seem to bounce around in the information zone, the mis and disinformation that we suffer from, and equally, our ability to look at a piece of news or a bit of information that's come to us and recognize its potential flaws. You know, the example that we spoke about recently, Sean, before this podcast, about how frequently statistics are used to demonstrate a case. And you find that by looking at the statistics, when you actually get underneath the hood,
yeah,
it's not just about the fact that it is misleading is that it's conveying a very, very different outcome to the one that's actually the case. And that is dangerous, in my opinion, and it's swaying opinion. And that if it is swaying opinion, and you are letting it sway your opinions, and you become more and more polarized, that's not healthy. So for me, my big takeaway from last year that I'm carrying into this year is all about the personal responsibility of data literacy to be able to deal with these kinds of things. So Sean, what's your big takeaway from last year?
I would always, actually just adding on to that, I think, because it's very, very symbiotic. There's going to be events that we haven't even thought of next year, this year. Yep. Black swans, there's going to be some really difficult inflection points strategically, I think. And of course, ethics is going to become even more front and center. And we're seeing that already, you know, with ICC and all the rest of it, I think. But there's several underlying themes, of which you've just mentioned a few there. But I think that, you know, from our perspective and from an analytics perspective, stay inquisitive, stay objective, mm-hmm. and whatever this subject is use analytical rigor.
You almost said tradecraft. You almost
said indeed.
All right. Well, look, thanks for listening. Happy New Year to you all. And let's see what 2025 brings. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, jains.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.